Human rights underpins much of our law, and we are in the midst of controversy yet again, with the government appearing determined to avoid complying with the European Court of Human Rights in relation to prisoner votes, and disappointed with the recent judgment of SIAC in relation to Abu Qatada. Today I'm talking to Fiona de Londres, Professor of Law at Durham University. Her research primarily focuses on questions related to effective rights protection, with a particular concentration on times of strain and crisis, and especially counter-terrorism. We're going to look quickly at the problems the US president faced with the closure of Guantanamo Bay, promised within a year of his inauguration as president 4 years ago, as a comparison, and then consider likely developments within human rights law in the United Kingdom in the next few years. Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to have you on. Guantanamo Bay, very complicated. 4 years ago, a president with the thoughts of the nation in his mind promised the closure of Guantanamo Bay, but it's not happened. What's the story there?
The story is, the story of a little bit of naivety on the one hand on the part of President Obama and a lot of intransigence on the other hand on the part of Congress. So President Obama, as you said, promised as a core part, in fact, of his original election manifesto to close Guantanamo Bay. And on the very first day of his presidency, he signed an order to put in motion a review that would lead to the closure of Guantanamo Bay. And that review, that task force, duly reported and announced that the vast majority of people who were there could either be released because they were no longer a threat, or could be they could be released to another state, or they could be tried, or a small number could be held or had to be held without trial or release. And so the question was essentially where would Obama hold them and how would he empty Guantanamo Bay out? And what happened in response to the task force report was the emergence of a very strong political rhetoric against the closure of Guantanamo Bay domestically in the United States.
Yes.
With a number of politicians saying things like these terrorists cannot be permitted to walk around the United States, when of course the suggestion was that they would simply be held in a prison. They weren't going to be, you know, allowed to wander around as they wished. And also saying that states to which some detainees might be transferred might not necessarily be trustworthy enough or capable enough of surveilling them in a way that would prevent them from, in fact, engaging in terrorist activity. And this is in spite of the fact that in almost all cases, none of these people had ever been found guilty of actually having engaged in terrorist activity. So the division of power in the United States provides that while the president, of course, directs military policy and so on, Congress has to approve all expenditures of money. Mm. So every year we have this large political crisis around fiscal appropriation acts and defense appropriation acts. And this is precisely the means that Congress have used to stop the president closing Guantanamo Bay. They've placed clauses in the acts that allow for military spending, which say none of this money can ever be used for anything that would lead to the closure of Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, that's quite an extraordinary provision. Going back a little bit, Guantanamo Bay was set up as a military camp in the wake of the Cuba crisis, was it not?
Yes.
And what's it been used for prior to the recent, the last 10, 12 years?
Well, it was largely used as a military presence, so it's actually under a perpetual lease from Cuba from the early part of the 20th century. But it has also been used to hold people. So President Bush was not the first person who thought that if he held people there, they might not be able to access the United States courts.
Yeah.
President Clinton used it for the Haitian boat people.
Yes.
To prevent them from reaching the United States mainland. Yeah.
So there is a precedent, and the difficulty here is, of course, if they're not subject, those who are detained at Guantanamo Bay, to American law, they enjoy none of the rights of people in the United States. Is that right?
Well, that was the hope.
Yes.
That was the thought behind it. And it you know, all the biographies of people who worked in the relevant departments in the United States government and so on make it quite clear that one of the reasons Guantanamo was chosen was so that the domestic courts could not, as they saw it, interfere in these matters. But in fact, there's been a series of cases by which the United States Supreme Court has said that at least some constitutional rights apply to people who are detained in Guantanamo Bay. What those constitutional rights are is not entirely clear, because the to be honest, the Supreme Court kind of fudged it a little bit in terms of the detail. But it is the case that at least some American law applies there. The difficulty is accessing that law, because it's very difficult to access your lawyer, and of course there is an atmosphere of distrust where somebody who's detained there is told this is your lawyer, and they don't really know if it is their lawyer or not. So it's, in practical terms, extremely difficult for people to use the rights that they do have in order to try to improve their lot.
Well, some of these detainees have been there for some time. And what's the state of play in terms of any likely trial?
Well, of course, it differs on a case-by-case basis, but I think it would be fair to say that it is practically inconceivable that everyone there would be given a trial. A lot of people who are there, you know, there is no intention to try them because, in fact, the hope is to release them. But they cannot be sent back to their original, their home country either, because their home country, some are considered extremely unstable, like Yemen, or because they are part of a persecuted minority in their home country, like the Uyghurs in China. So they're kind of in the limbo. Of the other people, I think we will see some, but not very many, being tried, and they will in all likelihood be tried in the military commissions and not in federal court.
Yes. Well, it's quite an interesting comparison to look at the difficulties that President Obama has and the practical difficulties our own Prime Minister has in relation to prisoner votes and indeed in relation to the recent Syed decision in Abu Qatada. Because I think it's fair to say that political and press sentiment in the United Kingdom is probably in favour of not giving prisoners rights, that they lose their rights at the door. But the fact of the matter is, we are signatories to the European Convention, therefore we're bound by decisions of the European Court of Human Rights, and the European Court of Human Rights has given very clear direction as to what we must do. Very quickly, could you summarise what the European Court has said we must do? I've covered this in a number of podcasts in detail, so we don't need to go into too much detail here.
Okay, well, essentially then, the European Court of Human Rights has said you cannot have a blanket rule where every single person who is detained on the basis of a criminal conviction has absolutely no capacity to vote. You know, it is an inequitable, disproportionate rule. It doesn't mean that every prisoner has to have a right. It just means we can't have an absolute blanket refusal to allow people to vote.
So where could we draw the line? At the moment, prisoners on remand are not considered as convicted for obvious reasons because they're not convicted, so they can vote. But do we have those who are convicted up to 6 months, up to 4 years, and those convicted over 4 years can't vote? Where do you think the line should be drawn?
It's a difficult one to really say because, as you may know, this idea of trying to find the point at which the restriction is proportionate or justifiable is not quite as scientific as it sounds.
No.
But my feeling would be that if we aligned it somehow to a regular general election cycle, that might kind of work. We said, okay, if the longest period of time during which you could not vote would be just less than a regular general election cycle, you know, that might be something that would work. But my feeling is that might even be considered a little bit too long. I'm not really sure, but I would say anybody who's convicted for less than, detained for less than 12 months, certainly that would be a bit much to say that they couldn't vote. Or it may not necessarily be in terms of time. I suppose it could be in terms of the perceived gravity of the offence. that one was convicted for. My own personal view is actually that no prisoners should be disenfranchised, that their punishment is the deprivation of their liberty.
Yes.
But that is not a view shared by many.
No, there are a lot of lawyers who actually share that view. But I think we are in the minority.
Yes.
In terms of Abrogatada, basically the suggestion is that the Home Secretary is about to appeal. I'm not up to date in terms of over the weekend, if there have been any developments at the end of last week or over the weekend in thinking, but there is an appeal being sought to the Court of Appeal. But Carl Gardner suggested that one way of dealing with this is to get Jordan to change their law to accommodate the SIAC concerns. What's your thought on that?
Well, certainly that would be one way of dealing with it, because the SIAC decision was essentially to say that as the law in Jordan stands, it is not clear that that evidence that had been acquired by means of unlawful means such as torture would not be admitted against somebody, but furthermore, that establishing that the evidence was not acquired by means of torture would not be something that lay on the defendant. In other words, it was about both whether or not it was possible that evidence would be admitted against Abrogatada that would be considered unlawful evidence in terms of Article 3 of the Convention, the torture provision, but also it was this concern that it would be the job of the defendant to establish that, rather than to raise a doubt and then have the state have to establish that the evidence was safe. So it could, in fact, be dealt with by means of an amendment to Jordanian law, I think.
Do you think that's the likely solution? I mean, that would still be subject to further review. It could be some years before we actually are able, lawfully, within our obligations under the convention, to actually deport him.
Yes.
How long do you think it could take?
It's possible that the UK might never be able to deport him. It's possible that they could deport him in 3 or 4 months if a swift change were made to Jordanian law, a new assurance were given, and there was a review again with the new with this new circumstance before SIAC. So really, how long it will take will depend on the speed with which the system moves in terms of making perceived accommodations and also the sufficiency of the accommodations. And, of course, the SIAC decision is a decision under the Human Rights Act.
Well, in previous podcasts, I've considered with many the nature of the European Convention. It was set up in the wake of the Second World War. We were not just early signatories to it, we took a very substantial part in its drafting. Mm-hmm. And it is said that Britain takes great pride in the fact that it complies with judgments of the European Court, hinting that others do not. What is the truth of this matter?
Well, it is, in fact, pretty much as you put it. The UK was one of the original members. It took an extremely prominent role in drafting the convention. It was not one of the first countries to sign up to the court, but once it did sign up, it found itself being confronted with some, I think the phrase often used is inconvenient truths around particular practices, and it had generally changed its law in response thereto. It has always been the case that there are some things, some provisions or rules developed in the court that the UK had not liked, one of which relates directly to Abrogatada, the rule around the absolute ban on deporting people to a place where it is likely that their convention rights would be violated, even if that person is considered to be a significant threat to the United Kingdom. Right from the start, the UK didn't like that rule,
but
nevertheless has always complied with it. So the UK's record is one of a robust compliance with the convention. It is also one of having put in place a very robust incorporation mechanism in 1998 through the Human Rights Act in order to try to change domestic practice so that our need to have recourse to the Strasbourg Court would in fact be rather slim, because in effect we would be convention compliant normally.
Yes.
And if we weren't, domestic courts would be able to see that and to remedy it. And generally speaking, you know, that has been working very well.
Well, the other side of the coin is the hint that some countries who are signatories have not complied. Are there many examples of that?
There are some examples, and it is a cause of, you know, concern in the court, and it's something that very much threatens the sustainability of the system, that a number of states, Turkey and Russia, for example, although they're not the only ones, do not have a marvellous record of compliance, I think, to put it charitably. Some other states comply, but very, very slowly. Ireland, for example, has a record of taking its very sweet time in complying with some decisions that it doesn't like, but nevertheless always gets there. So, yes, there are some states that do not have a marvellous compliance record. But what we have now is within the European Convention system, is actually a somewhat more robust enforcement mechanism over the last few years than we had previously. But the enforcement mechanism is largely, not fully, but largely dependent on what's called the Committee of Ministers. In other words, on the states, surveying and keeping in touch with and pressurising each other to comply with the judgments of the court.
Yes.
Reflects the character of the convention as an international treaty between states.
Now, part of our foreign policy, and this is the point made by Carl Gardner, is when we're dealing with countries abroad for political or commercial purposes, we do parade our human rights record, and we had an example of the Prime Minister recently in talking with the Chinese and raising human rights issues. It's going to be very difficult for Britain to maintain that with a straight face if we start cherry-picking compliance ourselves.
Well, I would have thought so, yes. Some states manage it, the United States being a very good example, but of course it becomes a matter of criticism for a state that does that.
Mm.
You know, so if a state is going around saying, we really think that you want to improve your human rights record, and that state itself is now developing a not-so-compliant approach to human rights, then the legitimacy of the message that they're bringing with them, of course, is reduced. And the point about cherry-picking is that it really goes to the heart of the rule of law. I mean, the rule of law, it doesn't mean that you can comply with things as long as they suit you.
Mm.
You know, you must comply with the law. And in the case of Abu Qatada, it strikes me, just to return to that example, not to mention the prisoner votes, it strikes me as extraordinary to have seen for the last week elected members of Parliament sit on national television and say, well, the Home Secretary should just put him on a plane and tell them this decision of the court. And this is a British court. You know, it is inconceivable, and there is no way that the government will do it.
No, I was astonished by that. But, I mean, this is political grandstanding, and there's a tendency for government to kick things into the long grass or kick the can down the road, I think is another phrase that's often used. Do you think we're going to end up with this prisoner's vote matter being put off till after the next election in 2015?
We may well. I mean, there is an excellent example just a couple of hundred miles across the Irish Sea of how a government can kick a European Court of Human Rights judgment down the road by setting up expert committees to decide what we might do, and then taking ample time to consider the report of the expert committee. So, you know, the next election is not that far away, and certainly it could be kicked down the road in this way. And it may be because if this becomes a matter that members or parts of the coalition, and particularly parts of the Conservative Party, decide they are going to use to try to press on stress points in their own party leadership, in their own government, politically, the government may not have any option but to defer this. But, you know, it would be better to defer it by means of setting up a committee that at least gives the impression of trying to comply, than by saying we're simply not going to comply with the decision of the European Court of Human Rights.
Well, that might satisfy the political appetites of of those who are in favour of disenfranchising prisoners, but it's not really the spirit of the rule of law, is it?
No, it's not satisfactory from a rule of law perspective, no. Certainly. No.
Much talk at the time of our last election here in 2010 about the new Bill of Rights for the British. I've lost the place on this one. I don't seem to see much activity at the moment. What's the state of play there?
Well, they've just finished a second consultation on the Bill of Rights. Mm. In fact, on the Bill of Rights website now, all of the submissions that were given in can be read. And I'm not sure what happens next. I guess that they compile a report based on the responses to the consultation. But I wouldn't expect that we would see very much meaningful action within the next, perhaps at all, but not within the next short while.
Well, for the benefit of many of the non-lawyers who listen to these podcasts, what was the government thinking in this Bill of Rights? What was the plan?
My understanding is that the idea here was we should have a British Bill of Rights that would reflect British values and would probably sit alongside the Human Rights Act, although it's not entirely clear how those two things are supposed to relate to one another.
No.
It's also not entirely clear whether this Bill of Rights is supposed to simply be a statement of values or whether it is supposed to have some kind of legally binding effect. All of these are questions that are up for debate within the consultation, whether or not this should replace the Human Rights Act or sit alongside it, what kind of duty it ought to put on courts and local authorities and so on. These all relate to questions that are being asked, which suggests that it's not at all clear or resolved what role this British Bill of Rights is supposed to play. And I suspect that it is largely a rhetorical exercise, that there is a feeling, or that there was a feeling, that rights, as they are now given effect by the Human Rights Act, are somehow not British, or somehow disconnected from values across these islands, which, given the history that we referred to earlier of the UK's involvement in drafting the convention, for example,
yes,
and given the fact that the Human Rights Act was drafted and implemented in a manner that is intended completely to facilitate the UK's constitutional structure, seems rather an odd position to take. And it may well be that both of those two things in the end show the futility of trying to put in place yet another system of rights protection that would merely confuse things further.
Well, that's certainly a view that I was beginning to come to, and I suspect is a view I will end up taking. I've read a fair bit of the stuff on the website, but I haven't read it all. But it does seem yet again to be a political solution to minimising the effect of European Convention and European Court of Human Rights in our own domestic policy.
Yes, I mean, that strikes me as being correct, and probably, I mean, it's difficult to really trace where this scepticism about the European Court of Human Rights entirely comes from, because it's not new for the UK to be a member. It's not new for the UK to have judgments against them that were unfavourable to the United Kingdom. It's not even new for that to happen in the context of something very sensitive like national security.
Mm.
Because we had cases relating to Northern Ireland. Now, the UK often was successful in those cases, but not always.
Yes.
So it is difficult to exactly pinpoint what it is that makes the European Convention now such a political hot spot. I suspect that the media's attention, or certain parts of the media's negative attention to decisions under the Human Rights Act that are considered to benefit wastrels or people who are somehow not deserving of rights has something to do with it. But it is a pity that the political system did not respond with principle rather than responding with politics.
Which difficulties do you think we're going to face over the next 2 or 3 years? What are the key topics? What's in your vision for the next few years?
Well, if we look across the continent of Europe, I think that there are probably 4 things that are likely to be problematic, and many of them will, I think, arise here in the UK as well. The first is around LGBT rights, because even though over, let's say, on this side of Europe, the debate is about marriage and about, you know, that kind of perceived last piece of the civil liberties jigsaw for gay rights. On the other side of Europe, we still have municipal authorities banning gay pride marriage marches,
yes,
for example, and very insidious discrimination and violence and homophobia and homophobic attacks. And I think that trying to get some governments there on board with the idea that since the early 1980s, it has been a clear part of European law that sexual orientation is an intimate part of one's personality that the state cannot try to infringe upon. That is, you have to get on board with that to be part of the European kind of public order. I think that would be a challenge. I think another challenge which will affect the entirety of the continent is the fallout from the financial crisis.
Yeah.
As the really severe impact of austerity on people's rights, on healthcare, on housing, on education, on your capacity to feed your family, and to what extent, when states are creating their budget plans, do they have to take into account the impact on people's rights? And in addition, to what extent, when the European Union, the Troika of the EU, the European Bank and the IMF, when they are creating their austerity conditions, to what extent, if any, are they to take into account the implications of full rights? I think that's going to be a really, really significant part of the rights discourse over the next couple of years. I think that the issues around terrorism and around the extent to which states can push the boundaries of what they do when it comes to counterterrorism will continue to be contentious, not only in terms of deportation, but last week on BBC Question Time, for example, the suggestion was, I can't remember who was there from the Labour Party, I think it might have been Harry Truman, the suggestion was that if we can't deport people, we're going to have to go back to the European Court of Human Rights and try to figure out this detention system. So there's a suggestion of returning to Belmarsh-type detention, which was quite surprising to me as well.
Mm.
These things will continue to arise. And the fourth, I think, major sparking point will continue to be how we negotiate the stress points of multiculturalism across Europe and what extent, and extent to which states can push what they determine or what they call a secularist approach in a way that, in fact, we make everyday capacity to engage in one's life in a religiously informed way, if that's what people want to do, extremely difficult. So not just headscarves, but also, I think, worship, halal food, and so on, that will continue to be a very contentious part of the human rights climate.
Yes, and that could be trigger a number of flashpoints in this country, because we are increasingly secularist in this country, and but it does raise quite complex and important issues. You know, I mean, we could probably talk about this for about an hour or more. There's just so much there. But as an overview, I'd like to thank you very much indeed for that half hour that we've just had, and for coming on this morning.
Thanks,
and perhaps we could explore in more detail the issues at a future time. But thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Stay on, and we'll have a quick chat. My thanks to Professor de Londras for that overview on human rights and the comparison between our own government with prisoners' rights and the United States government with Guantanamo Bay. I hope you enjoyed that podcast and it provides some food for thought. More to come. Bye for now.